I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a little bit about the development of American suburbia from the end of the Second World War onwards. It is a fascinating social transition that happens both in America and in Great Britain. And it was something that was ongoing really since the 1920s. We always think of suburbia as being a post-World War II development. But in both Britain and America, it's not. In the interwar years during the 1930s, Metroland developed from North London up into Buckinghamshire, and in America during the 1920s, 17% of Americans lived in suburban conurbations and developments. So what is suburbia? Well, suburbia is a 20th century phenomena as the development of trains and later automobiles enabled people to move outside towns and cities. The abundance of cheap fuel, and in America particularly cheap land, allowed towns to spring up from virtually out of nowhere, and for this to become part of this kind of intoxicating notion of the American dream, for it to be part of the promise of America in the 20th century. Bearing in mind that this is a concept predicated on cheap fuel, it certainly did have its limitations, as would be revealed from the 1970s onwards as fuel prices increased. And in lots of plays and books and films about suburbia, the white picket fences and the seemingly idyllic mowed lawns of suburbia very often became metaphors for a flip side of the American dream, a darker sense that an American dream, an American utopia, was on the verge of going badly wrong. You only need to watch the films of people like David Lynch, or more recently movies like American Beauty or The Virgin Suicides, to see that there is this kind of dark undercurrent that runs through discourses surrounding suburbia, but that's been in existence in American novels since the end of the Second World War. So there were already suburbs in America after, in the interwar years, but the thing that marks out the post-war years is its rapid acceleration. 11 million of the 13 million homes built between 1948 and 1958 were in the suburbs. By 1960, 33% of all Americans were suburbanites. So a third of the entire population was either living or had moved to the suburbs. And the archetypal cheap-to-build, affordable and very attractive suburban home was known as the ranch house. which was a long single-storey building with a double garage, normally two bathrooms, three bedrooms, and large lawns. Now, the thing about suburbia is that it is often sneered at for its kind of supposed conformity and banality and homogeneity. But most of the people that moved from the inner cities to the suburbs enjoyed immensely improved standards of living. They enjoyed, and this is also true of Great Britain, they generally reported that suburbia was a happy and idyllic place, it was well ordered, and that family could develop there, and many of the kind of the happier memories of people's middle years seem to have been had in suburbia. So despite what cultural critics have to say, most people really have enjoyed their experience of suburbia. The suburban experience was completed by shopping malls and retail developments that were developed outside the city centre and could only be accessed by car. So driving was the and car ownership was the thing that suburbia was built on. And this obviously excludes poorer people, normally poorer black or ethnic minority people. Suburbia in the post-war era was almost exclusively white. Suburbia was a response to housing shortage. The 1930s, during the Great Depression, seen little house building, and certainly there had been little built during the Second World War. It was so acute and so severe that old streetcars were sold to be used as homes in Chicago. By the end of the war, 250 of them had actually been sold to be used as housing. At the end of the war, sees a surge of money into the housing market. You have all these shortages and credit becomes relaxed again, so borrowing is possible. The Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration offered house buyers mortgages up to 90%. So these were federally backed mortgages of up to 90% on the value of a home. So there had never been a period of time in the US or probably the history of any other country where home ownership was so encouraged, so supported, so subsidised and so endorsed. And it was a bonanza time for American house builders. Now, I think I said in a previous podcast, America in 1945, that the experience, the post-war American boom, is hugely predicated on the actions of the state. The state, unfortunately to disappoint the wildest imaginings of extreme free marketeers, the state creates the framework in which market activity can maximise itself. So the state creates the lending conditions, it creates the guarantees that create a housing boom, and this is all vitally needed because there are housing shortages and veterans returning from war, and there was a popular consensus in America that the veterans' sacrifices should be rewarded in some way. And between 1944 and 1952, 2.5 million veterans are able to purchase homes with no deposit. A decade after the war, the Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration were providing 41% of all new home mortgages to the American public. Suburbia was an awful lot cheaper than urban dwelling. So people that wanted to move out of the city and they viewed there being plenty of reasons to move out, overcrowded life in the cities, crime, growing pollution and that sort of thing, they could actually move to suburbia and pay less money to do so. The increased car ownership makes that possible, and there had been a prolonged period of the building of federal highways, so transport links back into the city for when white-collar professionals needed to work, there was a great conduit to do so. But there was also a kind of a racial undercurrent to the developments of suburbia. More wealthy city dwellers wished to escape their poorer black neighbours, and in some cases their poorer white neighbours too. So there was a clear kind of class differential there as well. And they wanted to live in racially and socially homogenous neighbourhoods. They wanted neighbours who were people like us, you know, wealthy, well-to-do, professional types who you could play golf with or meet at the country club and have the social problems of America excluded and taken out of one's vision. And I suppose the ultimate expression of this now, developing in America and to some extent in the UK, is the gated community, where quite literally a fully privatised society sees security guards keeping the poor at bay. This process of suburbanisation and racialised suburbanisation has been referred to as the white flight from the inner cities. So because of this polarisation, the mirror opposite of the white suburb is the inner city black ghetto. The white flight to the suburb was one of two migrations in the 1940s. The migration that precedes it during the war years is referred to as the Great Migration. And actually, it's not exactly a phenomenon of the war years. It had been happening throughout the 20s and 30s. As poor black Americans fled the South, they made their way really on up the line of the Mississippi River towards the cities of the Great Lakes and to the northeast. And they worked in factories, on production lines. They worked as manual labourers. They worked in the service industries. And cities of the north, such as Chicago and Detroit, develop large black populations. This is particularly useful in places like Detroit for the motor industry. There's no coincidence that the record label that comes out of Detroit is referred to as Motown Records. Detroit had famously always been known as Motown. Many of the stars of Motown were found by its talent scout and first founder, Berry Gordy, on the production lines of the great American car industry. Now, the development of black and ethnic minority ghettos was to some extent an issue of personal choice. Black and ethnic minority people liked to live in their own particular ethnic communities, but also it was a great deal to do with white racism. There were very few opportunities to move out, partly because moving to suburbia or to anywhere else more desirable is expensive, but also because estate agents would refuse to show houses to black or ethnic minority or Latino or sometimes even Jewish American people in predominantly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant neighbourhoods. And also these restrictive covenants were introduced. Restrictive covenants were legal agreements across a neighbourhood that black people simply couldn't live there, that only white people would live there, that white people would be legally restricted under pain of litigation from their neighbours from selling their house to a black person. And this is described as legally unconstitutional and unenforceable by the Supreme Court in 1948, but this is largely ignored because it is extremely difficult to enforce. Banks would very often refuse to lend mortgages to black and ethnic minority people. The racist attitudes of developers, of city officials and other corporate institutions would discourage black people from leaving the ghettos. And in 1951, particularly in Cicero, white working class rioters burnt out from their neighbourhood black families. So sometimes, even in white working class neighbourhoods and ghettos, there was...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Racial violence to force blacks into black ghettos, to fully racially segregate America. Now, this is interesting because we have a period from the end of the First World War, and if you look at my podcast on the Red Summer of 1919, you realise there was an immense amount of violence at the end of the First World War, partly because black people had left the South or left their tradition, left their communities and started to work all over the country and work in all sorts of different roles. And there was an immense amount of violence, really, a kind of a violence of retrenchment to force the black people back to where white people thought they belonged, to the social or even the geographical position they thought they belonged in. And there seems to be the same, a similar process happening at the end of World War II. Black people's status had advanced during the war. They had been able to earn more money, work in better trades, live in more desirable locations and accommodation. And after the Second World War, there seems to be an immense amount of violence to force black people into ghettos. This isn't particularly a state-led phenomena. This is a kind of a grassroots social violence. And white people take with them their money. When white people leave the inner cities, they become reluctant to pay state taxes to redistribute wealth to the inner cities. They vote for representatives who will prevent this process. And the challenges and threats of desegregation in the later 1960s see southern whites leave inner city places such as Birmingham and Atlanta in Georgia, and there was particularly in Atlanta, there's a large white flight in between 1963 and about 1968. Two entrepreneurs in the 1940s were more renowned than anyone else for the creation of the suburbs. They were the Levitt brothers. And their creations were known as the Levitt Towns. The first came into existence at Hempstead on Long Island in 1947. They were often built for young veterans and their families, Hempstead, for example, had 17,000 homes, 80,000 residents, 7 village greens, shopping centres, 9 swimming pools and 2 bowling alleys. So it was meant to be an entirely new kind of community, one built around modern post-war ideas of social planning. There's an interesting parallel with the development of public housing in Great Britain after the Second World War. The term council estate has been very much demonised now in popular thinking, but the development of council estates and new towns after the Second World War in Britain were based around very similar kind of utopian notions, that there would be the recreation in kind of brick and concrete of villages that had existed before the Industrial Revolution. Obviously, this doesn't really come to pass, but this is part of the thinking, that people would be able to access amenities on foot. There would be, within the community, parades of shops and social clubs and that kind of thing. And you would really make better kinds of people. You would. There's a lot of paternalism in this. Some people in our times, in the 21st century now, might find this all rather patronising. It was meant with the best of intent, that you would really raise the condition of the working man and provide him with a nice community around and develop social cohesion. And a lot of it was based on very egalitarian notions. Now, in America, there is a reasonably equivalent to spirit of egalitarianism, but also it's built on notions of plenty, of abundance, of expanding frontiers, of America going places in the post-war era that could never have been imagined previous to this. I must add that this generally means white America. Because of shortages and because of the popularity of Levitt homes, there were long queues to buy them. They were fairly cheap. Normally priced about $8,000, which is 2.5 times average income. As you contrast that with today's UK house prices, and you get a kind of a picture about exactly how cheap they were. And they were pretty robust. They were had central heating and built-in amenities. And they were normally about twice the size of any other home. So this is something that Americans had never seen before, had never been treated to before. I mean, the contrast with the Great Depression is quite stunning. They were spacious, and American families grow accustomed to having spacious homes. The idea of cramped homes is something that is an anathema to sort of suburban visions. So suburbia is suffused with ideas of American plenty. Again, Levitt towns had no black residents at all. One black American family that did live in the Pennsylvania Levitt town were chased out of town. Stones were thrown at them. The federal authorities have to intervene in order to protect them. And the William Levitt himself said of excluding black people from Levitt towns, he said, "I've come to know that if we sell one house to a Negro family, then 90 or 95% of white customers will not buy into the community. That is their attitude, not ours." Now, the Federal Housing Authority had its own racial take on distribution of wealth. They didn't offer loans to applicants who were considered risky, poorer applicants, not to suggest that poor whites were excluded, because they certainly weren't, but also applicants who might elicit hostility from the white majority. Very often they refer to them as unharmonious racial or nationality groups, so black Americans or Jews. Residential segregation so became almost unspoken official policy of the USA. When we talk about the financial risk posed by loaning money to black Americans, there was very little done in terms of finding out the actual circumstances of black Americans. So a great many were quite financially solvent, but black was code for unreliable, work shy, and all these other racist notions, or feckless, or criminalised in some way. So the attitude in terms of housing was across the United States, not just in the South, but federally, was similar to the Jim Crow laws of the Deep South. Federally built highways enabled white people to completely bypass black parts of cities. They enabled suburbanites to be connected to white collar jobs in the city, and so it meant that it accelerated the decline of black areas, leaving them excluded. And there were plenty of public housing units, so America's equivalent of the council house, were built. But urban renewal very often meant the kind of the removal of black people from those areas. So you had a process of black communities being torn down and expensive new developments for white people being created, normally by corrupt landowners and developers and corrupt city authorities. And so the attempt to alleviate that shortage was ineffective. So only 325,000 federal housing units were built between 1945 and 1965, and many of them were failed developments. And the worst of those failures was the Pruitt-Igoe project in St. Louis. The Pruitt-Igoe project was a famous public housing system that was government funded. It was meant to be some kind of public funded utopia. It was 33. So it was a huge expanse of 11-storey apartment buildings that were built over 2 years, from 1954 to 56. They were high-dense, high-rise blocks containing 2,800 flats and apartments that could house 10,000 people. There were laundrettes, play areas and gardens. But by 1963, this project had begun to fall apart. The Pruitt-Igoe buildings seemed to have suffered from epidemics of crime. They were dirty. There was litter, broken windows. The elevators broke down. And the question was, the white response to this was, well, you give these things to black people and look what they do with them. However, the reality was the buildings were not particularly well designed or planned, and they weren't designed or planned with people in mind to live in them, particularly people, communities that didn't really know each other, that were flung together. And by 1972, the whole system was described as being an utter failure and was torn down. There had been too few facilities for people at Pruitt-Igoe. It was big, it was alienating, and there were too many vulnerable tenants there, many who were single women. There was a great deal of sexual violence that was prevalent in the Pruitt-Igoe development, and the things like the electricity and the water had become unreliable. And there were poor transport links. So that meant that poor, impoverished people became marginalised at Pruitt-Igoe and stuck there, and were, you know, people with jobs wouldn't live there. They would live somewhere else. And so it became an island of poverty in St. Louis. It was discussed about when postmodernism began, it was argued that the destruction of the Pruitt-Igoe building was one of the moments, one of the key cultural moments that signalled the beginning of postmodernism. Why? Because meta-narratives, big stories of progress, of advance, of modernity, fell apart with the failure of Pruitt-Igoe, and the thing that postmodernism, whatever you think that is, thrives on is the rejection of meta-narrative and the rejection of big stories and the embracing of chaos and confusion, I suppose. Anyway, postmodernism is a different conversation, and one hopefully we never get into. Anyway, I hope you found that interesting and slightly tragic. There is a few other podcasts like this that I've done. Check out America in 1945 and the Red Summer of 1919. Catch you next time on the Explaining History podcast. Thanks for all your support, and we're getting close to that big 100k. We'll be having something of an online party when we do hit 100,000. All the best, guys. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.